Hey everybody, this is Tim with TacticsTime.com, and I'm here with Anthea Carson today. Hey Anthea.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Good.
So it's been a couple of weeks since we last chatted, so you've been writing a lot of really good hub pages lately.
Yeah, I've been having fun with those.
Yeah, well they've been a lot of fun for me to read, and we've crossed paths a couple of times at the same events and across the board from each other, and that's been fun as well. So what would you say has been your best chess experience this summer?
This summer? Probably, I really like the Fischbein Simul, the Alexander, the Grandmaster.
Yeah.
I think he's from New Jersey.
Okay.
And he came to the Denver Chess Club and played a simul, and then, so I went, you were there.
Yeah.
And my son was there, Isaac, and he drew, you drew.
Yeah.
And Ted Doikos drew, and so did Chris Peterson.
Right.
Ted Doikos drew with the Smith-Morra Gambit.
Yeah, I saw that. That was pretty awesome, actually.
I didn't see the game. I'd like to see that game, actually.
Yeah, I played through really quickly. Chris's game was actually really interesting. I don't know if you saw that.
No,
at all,
I'd like to.
But,
I want to do a. I was planning to do a hub on all the draws.
Yeah, well, he had a win at the end. It's kind of a neat tactic.
Chris did.
Yeah, where he had a check with the rook on h8, and basically then he has a knight move, which will. Then he has a checkmate after that, but the knight move also hits the rook. It's kind of hard to describe, but I'll put a picture of the position up when I post the podcast. And
cool.
he had a, you know, Fritz had a prize like a +5 for him, where, you know,
wow,
clearly winning
+5.
Yeah.
So is that about the time that Fischbein offered the draw to him? Maybe he saw all that and Chris didn't.
Yeah, I don't know the exact story. he might have, because I think he was the one that offered the draw to Chris. So, and I think, you know, one of the things that's tough about simuls is if you're one of the last boards, you know, there's only two or three boards at that time, and at that point, the GM's playing basically at full strength because he's not, you know, trying to play
too many games,
too many games at one time, and so on.
Right.
And, so that was the first time you'd played in a simul, right?
That I had I've played it. I played. Can't think of his name right now. Ivanov.
Okay.
No.
Yeah, there is.
Came to Colorado.
That might have been him.
I think he's from, I'm not sure. I can't think of his name. I think it's Ivanov. But anyway, I drew a picture of him, actually.
Oh, okay.
I did a portrait of him while he was doing the simul, and someone put it in the chess informant at that time.
Oh, okay.
And this was years ago.
Oh, okay.
And, who else? Oh, many.
Yeah,
I've played many of those.
Okay, for some reason I thought you hadn't played in one.
Oh yeah, tons.
Okay.
And I've played.
Yeah, you
simuls.
Did, right.
I've done simuls too.
Right.
Against kids.
Right. Yeah, that's true.
In chess camps and stuff.
Yeah. So for someone who's never done a simul, what advice would you give them?
You mean playing against the?
Yeah, playing against the grandmaster,
right,
or whoever's giving a simul.
Well. I don't know. I don't have much advice because I haven't really had that much success. I mean,
yeah.
I don't think I've ever, you know, gotten a win or a draw. Or wait a minute. No, that's not true. I did draw. I think I either won or drew Bardwick, Todd Bardwick,
oh, okay,
when he did a simul in Denver.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a while back. And I was actually taking chess lessons from him at the time.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, I knew kind of a
right,
little bit more. I mean, I
right,
kind of knew.
Right.
And then I worked really hard that day. I remember I was there at the board for a long, all afternoon.
Right.
Just worked hard at the board and
yeah,
focused, and I don't know. But in the game against Fishbein, it turns out I just didn't understand my own opening at all. Because I play the boring opening. And yeah. He understood actually, I'm glad that simul happened. Because yeah. I ended up writing a hub page article about that game, which he told me I should. Because he said he thought that maybe he had thrown away a win at one point in the game. I did not understand my own system.
Oh, okay.
And which doesn't surprise me.
It surprised me because you seem to know that pretty well. I mean,
yeah, but you know, I don't. I mean, in reality, I don't know. I don't know whether it's a case of in chess, the more you know, the more you don't know, or whether I really didn't know it as well as I thought I did, you know? But I don't think I did know it as well as I thought I did. I know it better now than I did. Turns out I shouldn't have traded off my light squared bishop. I thought that was my goal, was to trade off my light squared bishop for his light squared bishop, because I thought that his bishop was more active than mine. But then after I wrote my hub page article, he told me that no, I shouldn't have traded it. That, and he explained why, that, you know.
Oh, that's cool.
It was, and yeah. It turned out my bishop was vital to stop his major plan, and I didn't. I didn't know that was the plan. And so now I do. I feel like I understand my own opening a lot better than I did.
Well, it was interesting for my game because I played the Budapest defense against him,
okay.
Which is something that I know pretty well. And I thought it worked out well because, you know, grandmasters don't play that opening themselves. So I felt like I got a really good position, and, you know, I ended up winning a pawn, but then I kind of grabbed the poison pawn, so I was up two pawns, but I shouldn't have grabbed that second pawn, and then I should have taken a pass, but I didn't, and then it kind of got an even position. Then I was basically able to get, like, a blockade-type position where there was no way he could really make too much progress, and then I offered him the draw, and I think he took it, in part because he knew that I had been winning, so, you know, he doesn't know me, so he doesn't know what I'm rated or whatever. But I was really happy with my game, and, you know, it was a lot of fun.
So you didn't have the same experience as me where you realized you didn't even understand your own opening.
Well, the Budapest is pretty straightforward, really. There's not a lot of variations. I don't know. It's
well, that's one of the problems with the boring opening is that it is boring. I mean, that's it. As Silman put it, there's no plan. So,
well, I don't think that's true.
There's no weakness to attack.
Yeah.
Right? From Black's point. There's nothing to attack.
Right.
But then so he was attacking. He did, I guess, is it a minority attack?
Right.
I don't know if it was a minority attack or just...
Yeah, I've seen a lot of stronger players do that, like when I would play the Kali or variations of that, you know, and when they launched their A-pawn and the B-pawn.
Yeah, that's what he did, and so...
And that's annoying to play against.
And then he got both rooks on... He had his rooks doubled on the B-file. He exchanges on the C file so that now I have he's got an open B file, right? I don't know if people listening can picture all of this, but if they sort of have to know the boring, but the C file, now I have the base pawn on the C file on C3, and he's got the B file open for his rooks, right? So he doubles on his rooks on the B file, and I can't get my rooks over there in time. That's basically what happened.
So the boring is a name you made up, right?
No.
Oh, that's an actual
name. That's Jeremy Silman's name.
Oh, Jeremy Silman. I thought you made that.
No, I wish. It was. Well, they sometimes call it the London system, but it.
Oh.
But I think, I'm not sure, the accuracy of all this, but basically, the way I see it is, it's the London system unless you play it against the King's Indian, and then it's the boring system. But that's that's from Jeremy Silman's Red Book.
I never knew that.
The complete, or what is it called? The Strategy of Chess book. Or
okay.
It's everything. He calls it everything you need to know, you know, in this book, right. This Red Book.
Yeah.
And it's in there. And also, I took a private lesson with him.
Yeah, I remember that.
That's when he talked about the, I mean, I heard him, you know, he taught me the boring at that point and told me, okay, you know, you can play this. Because I used to have a big problem when I would play the Collie and somebody would play the King's Indian, because the King's Indian, you know, shuts, it blunts the diagonal, the D3,
right.
H7 diagonal.
Right.
And so I didn't have a plan. I used to try to play different stuff. Like I would play the anti-Indian Collie,
right.
Which I suppose it's good because it's in Koltanowski's book and it's played, but I didn't really like it. And then there was another one too. I forget the other one. But anyway, the boring is one of them. Things you can switch to.
Oh, okay. I thought it was up there with the cheesecake, that it's just some local made up.
No,
weird
but
name.
Where does the cheesecake get its name? Because I'm not sure that's made up either.
I have no idea where these openings come from.
Because Paul taught that to Isaac. So.
Okay. Yeah. Anthea's son plays some opening called the cheesecake. Which is a variation of all of these D4 Collie type openings, and so. But anyways, that was good fun playing at the Simo and the Denver Chess Club. They've been kind of coming back to life here recently. Putting on some nice events.
Because Chris Peterson's really brought that club back.
Yeah.
From the dead.
Yeah.
Seems like they've got a good site now too at the what's the name of
the
that?
Tabor Center?
No. Have you been to the
Aurora campus?
No, the Denver Chess Club site.
Oh yeah.
On
yeah.
Tuesday night.
That's where the Simo was, right?
Yeah. Yes. And what's the name of that building again?
The community center, the
Grand Avenue Community Center. Anyway, that's a pretty nice site. I mean, when I first saw it, I thought it was a little funky because it's kind of a weird building. It's a historic building. I mean, it's a preserved building.
Right.
And during the winter months, it has a jazz band playing in the basement really loud. So, I mean, you're upstairs and they play great music. So they play like
So if you like
1940s.
Jazz, you can get a 2-for-1 chess and jazz.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty cool. And actually there's even some kind of, I don't know, music center down there, some kind of camp that kids can go to, guitar camp or something down in the basement, we found out.
Well, it's kind of funny for me because my friend Pete that I interviewed, he likes to make fun of the Denver Chess Club and all the terrible locations they've had over the years.
I know,
their
history has been. Yeah. So I was actually thinking of writing a Hub article about the history of the Denver Chess Club, you know?
Yeah, sort of like Pete's articles of... Did you see his Clogs and Plungers article?
No, you got to send me a link for that.
Okay, that's on my timmybx.com blog where he talked about how the toilets were always broken.
Yeah, and there was some mysterious chess player doing something to those toilets. And we thought, we actually remember we were back at the VA, what was that first?
The VFW?
The VFW, that's right. And it's not, that building's not even there anymore.
Right.
And they used to have, I used to like, well, that location was okay. There was a lot of cigarette smoke, though, and they had a bar downstairs.
Right.
And so
Some
seedy characters, and some of the parents complained.
Well,
it was, you know,
kind of a seedy neighborhood, too. I mean.
But they had a great restaurant across the street.
Yeah.
And then, so we got thrown out of there, and we thought they were unfairly blaming us, remember?
Right.
Do you remember the night we were thrown out and someone called the news?
That was Pete that called the news, yeah.
We were standing out there on the street, wanting our chess game, and...
Yeah, I was talking with Fred Spell, and just saying, you know, that this is a really good time for Colorado chess right now. There are a lot of... organizers that are enthused.
Right.
There's a lot of good playing sites. You know, it's spread out. There's stuff in Pueblo and our area here around Colorado Springs.
Fort Collins,
and Denver
too.
And
right.
Even out in western Colorado, they're having events. They were having one in Utah this weekend.
Moab.
Moab, yeah. And they're having this one up in Wyoming that...
oh, yeah, the Wild West.
Yeah, both of us are planning on going to that. That's, I think, in 2 or 3 weeks.
That's an exciting tournament. There's a lot of prize money in that. I'm excited for that. In fact, that may turn out to be the best chess event of the summer because it's got... They've got family. They've got a barbecue.
Yeah.
They want it to be, you know, a family event.
Right.
There's a lot of prize money. It's a low entry fee.
And it's class sections, so...
Right.
So
which means if I can manage not to blunder... I don't want to play you for the game. That was awful. I hated you. I hated chess.
So they recently had a Bobby Fischer tournament here that also had some enormous prize money. All 100% of the entry fees went towards prize money, and it was in a really good location. I did a podcast with Fred Spell about the tournament before it happened, and it turned out really nice. They had coffee before the rounds. They had,
although they ran out.
Yeah, they kept running out, but they had little plaque cards with everybody's name.
Oh, yeah.
It was really, really...
I was really impressed, too, that, like, the directors, I think, were wearing suits. Yeah. You know, just like...
Yeah, it was nice.
You know, treating chess like a...
Giving it some dignity.
Of course, then I show up with my, I don't know, running shorts or
robbing
something.
It of all the dignity.
Tank top.
So yeah, that was a good tournament, and I think this Wild West tournament is gonna be good.
I'm
gonna be doing the Simo in that one too. GM Kudrin.
Yeah, you know, that's a good idea. You know, I think I might, that might be a good hub article to write about the chess Simo, or about this thing coming up in Wyoming, because it does deserve to be promoted quite a bit. I mean, there's a lot to be said for this tournament because there's a lot of prize money.
Yeah.
The entry fee is really low.
Right.
I'm not sure what the rates are at the hotel, but there's even...
It's normal at like $100 a night or something.
It's normal. And there's also, there's like a comfort. I mean, you don't have to even stay at the hotel. You can go to... I mean, it's in Saratoga, but that's not too far from...
I'm excited because I've never been to Wyoming before. So. Even though I've lived in Colorado for 10 years.
There's been a lot of tournaments in Wyoming, though.
I know. I've never gone, so.
It's kind of nice there. I mean, it's just kind of peaceful. There's not a lot of... There's just... It's very sparsely populated.
Yeah.
But anyway, so, okay, so they have a SIML. They have a Game 15 tournament.
That's the U.S. Game 15 championship, I think.
Wow.
Yeah, so you can add
maybe
another
I can win
title
the,
to your...
the women's Game 15 champion. Unless Nino Nelson decides to pop in.
Right. So we're just joking because Anthea won the U.S. Game 60 was held in Durango... What, 7 or 8 years ago?
Yeah.
And Anthea, was there actually a woman?
There were other women there. There was another woman there who was about a 1300 though.
Okay.
So.
Okay.
So you know, I think at the time I was 1600.
Right.
So.
Well, that'll be cool. You can put that on your resume.
That was actually the first time I've ever touched a piece and tried to not move it.
Oh, really?
And I've never done that in my life because I considered it just awful, you know, immoral or something.
Yeah, yeah.
But I made such a horrible blunder that I thought no one was looking, and I actually tried
caught?
To take it back. And somebody caught me and made a huge fuss out of it, you know.
Really?
And I took it back, and I was just, like, ashamed, and I'll never try that again.
Wow.
Yeah.
Huh. Did I tell you about how your son... He tried to castle. He moved his king from e8 to d8, and then he tried to castle queenside after that. After he had moved, this was in Pueblo.
Did he know, or
I don't know. Well, I don't think he tried to do it on purpose. He just confused.
Yeah,
or whatever.
That happens. Right. That's happened to me.
Right, but then I made him move his king as well. Then he tried to move another.
That's awful.
Then he tried to move another piece, and I was like, no, you got
to
move your
king. Yeah, I think I had to. I think when I did that, I had to move my king too. Fortunately, I think it was a good move. But
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've never had anybody, I think, touch a piece, then try to touch another piece. There was, awful
I did that.
There was a famous game.
I'm glad I didn't get away with it.
There was a famous game between Kasparov and Judit Polgar. Yeah. Have you heard of this?
Yeah, I know about that. Yeah. In fact, I tried to write a Hub article about, well, I was writing one about touch move, the touch move rule, and I found a whole bunch of websites that talked about this game where he touched a piece and she tried to argue that he had touched the piece, and then he argued no, he hadn't.
See, I thought he didn't. I thought she didn't say anything.
No, it turns out they had video footage of it, and then they ruled in his favor, and I thought that was just awful that they ruled in his favor after they had footage of it.
See,
I couldn't find footage.
I thought she didn't say any, like, she saw it, but she didn't say anything because it's Kasparov, you know.
I think she did, but then she backed down.
But then afterwards, she saw the videotape, and she knew that he had done it, and then, but for you, then, like, the next time they played, she wouldn't even shake his hand.
I don't blame her.
Yeah.
It makes me have a whole new, of course, I admire Kasparov. I mean, I know, okay, maybe he did that, and I don't like that either, and I can see why she's upset about it. But, you know, he's one of the chess players that I probably admire the most.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, because he's, first of all, he's sane, which is unusual for a chess, even just a chess player in general, but let alone a chess world champion.
Yeah, I mean, he's pretty well adjusted.
Although Anand seems very well adjusted, too. But, I mean, after Fischer and some of the others that you read about, I forget which one, when we watched the documentary, which one it was that thought he was playing a chess game with God. He was a...
Oh, was it Tal or...
No, not Tal. He's pretty normal. He's actually fairly normal.
Yeah, there was one of them
Steinitz,
that,
I think it was.
Yeah, and he gave... Didn't he give God a pawn advantage or something?
And, you know, so I just admire the fact that he's sane.
Right.
Let alone, you know, then I kind of... Okay... I feel like he, as far as strength-wise goes, there's nobody better. I don't think there's ever been or ever will be anybody better than Kasparov, but as far as strength goes, until he reached his, I mean, until I guess he started to decline as, I mean, when he realized he wasn't at his peak anymore. But but I think he was probably, I mean, I remember I asked Brian Wall, who do you think is the best chess player in the world? And without even a thought, he said Kasparov, and then I asked him why, and, you know, he talked a little bit about just how strong he actually was. I mean, so, yeah, I mean, Kasparov may have touched a piece and moved it, but...
Yeah. Well, so speaking of that documentary, when that came out, I ordered HBO that day just so I could watch it, and ended up having a bunch of people come over. Paul Grimm came down, and Anthea came with her kids, and Paul Anderson came with his family, and it was a lot of fun to watch. What did you think of that documentary?
Oh, it was fascinating. I'd like to see it again.
Yeah.
And then it turns out our own local Brian Wall was in that thing at the end, playing backgammon in Harvard Square. That's funny.
Yeah, I posted a picture of that on my website.
Especially considering what a fan he was of Fischer, too.
Yeah.
I mean, he loves Fischer. But yeah, Fischer, I thought it was really interesting. I mean, there was all kinds of things that I didn't know before that I learned from that. I didn't know all that stuff about his mother.
Right.
I didn't know, for example, that his mother tried to take him to see a psychiatrist for his chess obsession when he was 7 or 8 years old. That's fascinating.
Yeah, and it was a little bit of foreshadowing when the psychologist says, well, there's a lot worse things to be obsessed about than chess.
Which turned out to be true, because after he left chess, he became obsessed with just... And then I found it fascinating. Like, I had a whole new perspective on it, because when he was obsessed with chess, he was a great chess player. But when he left chess and became obsessed with politics, he just had these insane, irrational theories that might have been really creative on the chessboard.
Right.
But in reality...
Yeah.
They're just delusions and paranoia.
Well, I went on vacation last week, and I just finished reading Frank Brady's Fischer book, Endgame.
Oh, I want to read that.
Yeah, and it's a really good complimentary piece to the movie. A lot of it's the same, but they get a lot more into his life. The movie pretty much focused on the championship, where, like, the Endgame book focused a lot more on what his life was like when he was living in Iceland and his whole time in jail in Japan and living with the Polgars in Hungary and kind of his life after the 72 match as well. And so, you know, I thought they were both really outstanding.
Yeah, I mean, that book looked really interesting. I wanted to read it. Maybe I can...
Yeah, you can borrow mine if you want. I just finished it.
And, yeah, I'd like to, because it really, I don't know, it just gives a real human side to the person, yes.
And I thought it was interesting, too. I saw a lot of people posting on Twitter that aren't even, like, chess players, how they watched the movie and it made them want to go play chess.
Yeah, which is great. Yeah. I mean, I love it when people decide they want to play chess or when chess is given more public attention. And I think Fischer did, I mean, it's pretty well established that Fischer did a lot for chess.
I mean, it was amazing to me. I mean, I knew it was popular in 1972, but I had no grasp that the evening news was literally starting. You know, there was a big break in the Watergate case today, but first, Bobby Fischer news. I mean, I know.
Can you imagine that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that was mind blowing.
I know. I was a kid. I mean, I vaguely remember, you know, because I was about, what, 6 or 7 years old at the time, and I remember hearing a lot about him. But of course, I was just learning how to play chess, so. Right. Didn't really, but I remember the excitement, you know, about it, because there was a lot of buzz about him, and he's an interesting character. We talked too, and the documentary focused on this too, that, you know, were we fascinated with Fischer because of his incredible chess skill? I think we were, but I think it was maybe also his eccentricities.
Oh yeah,
I think, I'm not sure, you know, which. Was it the chess, was it the amazing skill, or was it the eccentricities? Because Kasparov had amazing skill, too.
Right.
But, you know, you don't see the kind of focus.
Nobody cares.
Nobody
yeah.
cares. Now, is that because he's Russian, and he's not American, and so Americans cared? But no, the whole world seemed to care about Fischer.
Well, yeah, I mean, a lot of these sports stars, if they have both, if they have great skill and some sort of interesting personality, then they just become larger than life. But, you know, if they just have the skill, but, you know, if someone like Roger Federer that is amazing at tennis, but, you know, doesn't, he's not weird or anything, you know?
Yeah. You know, speaking of which, well, not that this, actually, I don't think there's anything weird about this person at all, but, well, I was doing a little bit of research on the game of Go versus the game of chess in China, because a friend of mine and I were having a philosophical debate about whether Go was more complex than chess. And so I looked a little bit at what they're saying about chess in China right now. And apparently this young girl, I'm not sure her age. I think she's a teenager. I know she's a teenager. Okay. Hao Yifan.
Okay, I don't know.
I wrote a Hub article about her. Yeah, that's her name, Hao Yifan. She's the women's world champion right now.
In chess. Really?
Not in Go, chess, yeah. And apparently it's raised quite a bit of excitement about chess in China. Just this young teenage girl.
Really?
And I think she's really young. Like, I don't know if she's, well, she's, she may be 16 now anyway, but I think she became a GM. She was one of the youngest to become GM. She was very young to become a GM.
Huh.
And she was the youngest ever champion of China, male or female.
Wow.
So she's pretty, they're pretty excited about her over there, I think. And I think it's doing a lot for chess in China.
Wow.
I'm not,
well,
you know.
Pete was actually just in China for 3 weeks for work.
Oh, really?
And, yeah, and he asked the people, like, is there anywhere that people play chess, or is there anywhere I can go to play chess? And they said, like, there's some park or something, but it was actually in, like, the Russian district or something like that. So there were all these, like, old former Soviet guys sitting around, you know, playing chess or something.
So chess is not that big in China.
Well, according to Pete, but, I mean, I guess a lot of them play Chinese chess or something.
Which is a different game.
Yeah, which is a totally different game.
I don't even know how much it resembles chess.
Yeah, I mean, I think
guess it.
Somewhat. I mean, they have so many people there that, you know, I don't know, but that would be cool, you know, some Chinese female.
Well, I think it's exciting.
Yeah, it is exciting.
For one thing, I feel like there must be a lot of potential with this girl.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I love the idea of there being a woman's world. I mean, that a female would someday win. Of course, I love that idea.
Yeah.
You know, that a female would win the world championship, period. Not just the woman's world, but the championship. I love that idea.
Right.
And I think the one that came closest was Judith Polgar, of course.
Well, yeah. I mean, she was ranked in the top 10 in the world.
Yeah, I know.
And
she's, I don't know how much better she is than Hao Yifan. Probably quite a bit. I don't know. I think that the gap between, you know, Judith and Polgar and Hao Yifan is enormous. I'm not sure. Like so there's Judith Polgar, and then way down, you know, then comes the next woman chess player. I don't know.
So you wrote a hub page about her?
Yeah, about Hao Yifan. It's called Woman's World Champion or something like that.
I must have missed that one.
Yeah, it's just a little bit about her. It shows one of her games and she started playing when she was 3. I guess her dad took her to they used to go to a little shop, and she was fascinated with the chess pieces in the window at 3. And so her dad bought her a set.
Wow.
And then I think she beat her dad very quick, very soon after learning the rules or something like that. Like, she either beat her dad or corrected her dad making an illegal move at a very young age. Yeah, and then she just had enormous talent.
Huh.
You know, after that. So.
I liked in that Fisher movie when they're interviewing him and they were saying, like, when did you learn chess? He's like, 6. And then they're saying, when did you become serious about chess? He's like,
7.
7, yeah.
I know. So. And he was really obsessed with it, the game. And I've thought about that a lot. Like, that is what it takes to be great.
Right.
And yet, sometimes I feel like the more I study, the worse I play. I don't know. I mean, I've had that experience, you know, where I study my brains out, and then I go to a tournament and hang a bishop. You know, just hang a piece. Just like, okay, what did all that study accomplish exactly? Because I can't concentrate.
Right.
And maybe I can't concentrate because I'm just tired of it. I just need a break. But then I think, well, you know, taking breaks from it all the time, that's not how you get good. You got to study all the time. Fisher did, certainly.
Yeah, well, the other thing I was kind of surprised about in the movie was what a fitness fanatic the guy
was.
True. I mean, they interviewed his one personal trainer and who's worked with all these Olympic athletes, and they were just saying that Fisher was just an animal, you know, that he was constantly working out.
I think that's cool,
He was an excellent swimmer, and he was real into all these aerobics, and which was something I had never really realize it, you know. They said he took it really seriously, you know, your mind and body.
And they are connected,
So,
yeah, I mean, I've heard that said before. Other people have talked about how to improve their chess. One guy I knew used meditation, you know, to try to improve. I feel like for myself, I have to develop some kind of disciplined methodology for calculating moves. Just check every capture, every legal move, every capture, every check, every, you know, and that you have to do that every move. You can't get lazy and say, well, this looks like an easy move. And especially when you're doing some kind of combination, which is what I did that with that game that ended in a draw because I went to the Bishop Knight.
Yeah, let's talk about that. So your latest Hub page article was a game, I thought this was really interesting, where you forced your opponent into a Bishop and Knight versus Bear King endgame, which is a win for the person with Bishop and Knight, but it's not easy at all to do.
Not at all. And my thinking was, because he pushed a pawn, and as soon as he pushed that pawn, I sacked the bishop, you know, without even thinking twice. I'm going to sack the bishop and force him to checkmate me with a bishop and a knight.
What was his reaction when he did this?
Well, I think at first I think he was probably happy about it because now
he's up two pieces.
He's up two pieces, and I still had a runaway pawn, but he could catch it. In fact, I was nervous that if I chased that, if I actually tried to, I thought that if I tried to queen that pawn, I might get checkmated due to the pawn occupying one of my squares. Right.
Oh, okay.
I thought that could happen conceivably, right, that I could go up there with my king trying to queen that pawn and then get checkmated because I can't capture my own pawn.
Right.
So I decided, no, I'll run the other direction with my king and I'll make him waste 10 moves chasing my pawn.
Right. But then that doesn't count towards your 50 moves, right?
It does. Oh, you're right. It doesn't. The capture. Well, you're right. Yeah, you're right. Never mind. That explains why when I said, oh, it's been 50 moves, and Jerry said, well, there was a capture. So I had to start over from that move. Okay. And then I had to add another 10 moves.
So, okay. So
you're right. It didn't work.
Okay, I gotcha. So, yeah, so you wrote this article, and you put a video on there about how to actually do it. I wouldn't have been able to do it, I don't think.
I wouldn't have either.
Yeah.
I can't, and I used to teach it.
Oh, I thought you knew how to do
it. I used to. I used to teach for California Youth Chess League in Santa Clarita near Los Angeles, and I taught in the after-school program. And I had a little worksheet that I used, and I had it down to a science. I could do it. It was no problem. There was, you know, there was something about the W in there, the W formation, and then you waste a move with the knight. And I was teaching it. And then, like, I don't know how much time went by between the last time I taught it and the first time I tried to do it again.
Right.
But then I realized, to my horror, that I could no longer do it.
Right.
And then I remember one incident where three masters were trying to teach me how to do it, and I could not learn it. And it was like, did the part of my brain that could ever understand this die at some point?
Right.
You know what I mean?
So when you were playing against him with the Bear King, were you, like, purposely trying to go to the bad corner? Were you
doing... Yes, okay. Absolutely. Because I knew that. I mean, enough of it. I've retained enough of what I knew to know that you don't go to the corner that has the same color as his bishop, square as his bishop.
Right. So he had a light square bishop.
Yeah, and he spent such a long time in the wrong corner trying to try. And I was just enjoying the heck out of that because it was like, go ahead, keep trying. And I thought maybe he might even stalemate me.
So how many moves did the game end up going?
50. And then I called a draw.
I mean, it must have been over 100 moves for the whole game.
Oh, yeah. I guess it would have been 100 moves for the whole game, yeah. But I had to call the draw, or I called the draw, because it was 50 moves after the last pawn capture.
Were you in time trouble at all, or?
He was in time trouble.
Yeah.
This was an odd time control we had. It was game 30 with 30-second time delay.
Oh, okay.
And it was, and they had the clocks all set up to do that, and it was at the Fountain Valley tournament. It was a nice location. They had a really nice location. It was at the Salvation Army there. Paul Covington arranged it. It was nice. I really enjoyed it. But the time control was odd.
Okay.
You know, I've never played in that. Game 30 with 30-second time delay.
So you get 30 seconds to make your move before the clock starts going, or does it add 30 seconds each time?
That's a good question. I'm not sure if it's increment or delay.
Okay.
That's a good question. It seemed like it was increment, because it seemed like I would have a certain amount of time, and then I'd look over and I had more time. But you had to keep score. You had to keep keeping score, even if you only had seconds.
So there was none of this, okay, I'm under 5 minutes.
Right, none of that.
I have an hour, but my opponent's under 5 minutes,
now,
I don't know if they can...
I did notice that my opponent stopped keeping score, and I could have called him on it if I wanted to. But, you know, I'm not one of these hardcore chess players that calls all the little rules. And I can't stand it when someone does that. Even though I know they're following the rules, I never like it. It just seems
I know Pete's gone ballistic, like, when his opponent doesn't keep the score, you know. And the one time... he was playing Josh Suresh at that camp up in Denver. Like, remember that Girl Scout camp that Joe Haynes?
That had to be the most hilarious location you've ever had.
So Pete's playing Josh, and Josh isn't keeping score.
Right.
So Josh has, like, 6 minutes on his clock, and he stops keeping score. So Pete's like, you have to keep score until you have less than 5 minutes on your clock. So Josh might have like 7 minutes or something.
Right.
So what he does is he's like, okay. So Pete starts the clock. He sits there and he waits till his clock is under 5 minutes.
And then he starts playing.
And then he starts playing. Because he has a clearly winning position.
Oh, and that's hilarious. And,
just to make Pete go
just
ballistic.
To make Pete go ballistic. It's so funny. Well, I know that, you know, when someone calls the rules on me, they're actually playing chess correctly.
Yeah.
They certainly have the right to do it. But I just can't bring myself to do it.
Yeah, you
know? Call those kind of rules.
I'm not too hardcore about that, you know. I mean, if someone isn't going to keep score at all, that kind of annoys me, you know. But I don't know. I don't really put too much. I don't get too worked up about it either.
Right.
But
yeah, that is an interesting thing. And then so, as far as the checkmating with the bishop and a knight goes, you know, people. I often will say, well, why do you need to know that? It's never going to occur in a real game. It's occurred in 4 games for me now.
Really?
Yeah.
I was going to ask you that. Wow, that's a lot.
First of all, I deliberately made it occur in this game.
Right.
But also, Shannon Fox deliberately made it occur against me in a game.
Were you able to do it?
No. And he kept the 50 move rule.
I didn't know that.
And he was just smugly sitting over there with his move 50. And I mean, oh, I was so mad.
Really?
At him.
When was
but,
this?
Yeah, I just basically. This was back at the DCC, I think, when Denver Chess Club, when it was located at.
I kind of vaguely
that one that. Church where went that underground. We were in the basement. Well, I think we were in the basement of some church.
The one that was all dark and people were bringing their own lights and stuff.
Yeah.
So, well, I know one time there was a bunch of us in Reno, and Reno was one of the last tournaments that did adjournments, and Tyler Hughes was playing somebody. And Tyler did the same thing you did, where he got the person into a bishop and knight versus bear king.
Oh man! And then they had an adjournment.
But then they had an adjournment, so the kid had time to go and look it
learn
up on the
it.
Internet and watch a YouTube video and take a private lesson and buy a book at the bookstore.
Oh, that's funny.
Came back and you know.
Well, it's a great tool to use to try to force a draw when you're a piece down, and that's it's a great idea, you know, and. So it is something to know.
Yeah, it's almost like a tactic in itself, you know, especially, you know, maybe not at the master or above level, but certainly in the, you know, A section, B section, C section, you know, a lot of players aren't going to know how to do that. So
right, and so I was proud of myself when I even got that got there. Because, you know, sometimes you can't. Sometimes your opponent...
Well, it sounds like you were probably losing anyways. And...
Well, I was down a piece, but I had one pawn for the piece.
Right.
And I just thought, well, that's what I'll do. I'll try to make it so that he can't make any progress, and I'll try to trade pawns as soon as... I'll try to just keep trading pawns until we're out of pawns, and then I'll try to trade that rook.
Right.
And then that's what happened.
Well, that was clever. Very good.
Yeah.
So... Well, thanks, Anthea. I think it's been really interesting, and you've been writing a lot of really good hubs lately. Is there any other ones you want to mention before we go here?
Well, the ones that I like are the ones where I'm able to get an actual like video where it's my own video, and it's like the one I did of Alexander Fishbein, where I was able to interview him and hear him talking about chess in Russia. I'd actually like to do more of those kind of hubs where I get to interview somebody interesting and do a little video and stuff like that. And then also people really seem to like the celebrity hubs. The one about Humphrey Bogart got a lot of hits. They didn't apparently know he was a chess player.
Right.
Sting, people were interested in that. Che Guevara. So people just... And in fact, I was thinking about doing one about chess inside the prisons too,
because
there's a whole lot of information about that, about chess games that are played from inside the prisons.
Yeah, one of my favorite prison story chess stories is, do you know the one about Claude Bloodgood?
Yeah, well, that piggybacked on what I was already kind of working on something, yeah, because I had heard that Charles Manson was actually a fairly decent player.
Oh, Charles Manson,
yeah,
was.
But I couldn't find any of his games, but I have heard that he was actually not that bad of a player, like maybe an 1800 or something.
Well, Bloodgood was the guy that, he played the Grob a lot, which is how
yeah,
I know
that's,
him.
That's right, yeah, that's right,
I actually have his book, and, so anyways, he was in the prison, so he got all these prisoners, like USCF memberships, and then, you know, he was probably, you know, as good as you and I are, you know, like
right,
a B player, and so he played all these, you know, prisoners who didn't know how to play, but he got them ratings, and then he just beat them up until he was like one of the top 10 players in the U.S.
Oh, geez,
and
hilarious.
He actually got invited to the U.S. championship because of his rating.
Because of his overinflated rating.
Yeah, and then they found out he was in prison. So,
that's,
I mean,
hilarious.
He was a real interesting character.
One of my biggest fears is that if I were ever to end up in prison, not that I would do anything that would get me there, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
If I were to ever go to prison, I wouldn't. There'd be no chess for me, like, because there's no women playing chess.
Oh, I didn't
certainly
even think
not,
of that.
Yeah, certainly not in the prisons. Well, so, you know, if I was a guy, I could always say, "Well, I'll play chess for the rest of my life."
Right.
It's what I would do anyway.
Right.
But now, if I had to go to the woman's prison, I'd be like, oh, "That's it for me. No more chess."
Well, the thing that Bloodgood did, I guess, wherever he was, I think it might have been Virginia. Like, the prisoners were allowed to. They had as much postage as they wanted, so he played correspondence chess, and he had like literally thousands of games going at one time, and the taxpayers were paying for all the postage for all these correspondence games, so he was racking up, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars postage cards and stamps and stuff.
You know, he had to have something to do, I guess.
Yeah, so you could always play correspondence.
I could play correspondence. Never played correspondence, but I probably would start at that point out of desperation.
Yeah.
Or I'd try to teach the women. I mean, I've been in situations where I'm around nothing but women before.
Yeah.
I was in a situation once where it was all women. It was like a home, you know, a house, not a detention center, but just a house for all women.
Yeah.
And I tried as hard as I could to teach those women to play chess, and it was just like pulling teeth. It was awful, and a lot of the girls were actually intrigued with the game, but they just didn't have that competitive nature,
That's funny. It was awful.
It was just awful.
Well, hopefully that never happens, but if so, I'll play correspondence for you.
Yeah, that's good. Thanks, Tim.
All right, well, thanks, Anthea.
All right.
Okay.